Welcome to the Behaviorist Book Club. We are a community of practitioners focused on helping your clients achieve meaningful and socially significant behavior change. This is your host, Matt Harrington.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Behaviorist Book Club. We are going to continue reviewing behavior analysis research articles, and we're going to Behavior Analysis in Practice. This was published in 2022, and it's called Repetitive Speech and Problem Behavior, a Functional Analysis of Precurrent Contingencies by Strohmeyer and colleagues. This was published up in the Neurobehavior Unit up at the Kennedy Krieger Institute, which is something we'll get into a little bit later. So at its core, this article is about man compliance as a function. And this is including a couple of functional analyses and a couple of treatments that resulted in the reduction of challenging behavior associated with this contingency. And honestly, when I read this title, I wasn't really sure what precurrent behavior really was, but it's simply a behavior that influences the probability of reinforcement for a subsequent behavior. So the authors gave a great example. They said, it's like reading a recipe to increase the chance of cooking cookies that work out, right? So before you cook the cookies, you make sure you review the recipe and then you bake. And then your cookies are likely going to result in reinforcement from yourself because you know that you're eating those cookies by yourself. So what we're looking at here is precurrent speech in the way of repetitive speech. So as a precurrent to man compliance, and then the man compliance is the function of the behavior, right? Let's say a client is asking about something recurrently or engaging in a lot of repetitive speech, and then that repetitive speech makes it more likely that caregivers are going to reinforce the man that subsequently follows it, results in the maintenance of that behavior occurring in the future. Man compliance has been thrown around a lot as a potential new function or extension of functions, and this conversation doesn't really get into the entire complexity of that discussion. One of my personal favorite takes on it is, isn't man compliance more of a value? I think Brian Middleton from The Bearded Behaviorist told me, we were having a conversation about that, because all functions are essentially man compliance, right? Manding for attention, manding for access, manding for escape, manding for allowance to do automatic sources of reinforcement. All of those things are basically just types of man compliance. But specifically what we're talking about here is typically vocal mans that result in, if they're not followed through with, then problem behavior occurs. For example, a client manding for a unavailable snack or an unavailable activity, the teacher says, no, we can't do that right now, I'm sorry, and then problem behavior occurs as a way to access that activity or that attention or et cetera, et cetera. So you can already see, even in that explanation, how man compliance can get complicated and mixed in with a lot of other different functions. We're gonna take a break from that kind of discussion and debate. I think it is worthwhile. There's some good articles that go through the complexities of that debate that might be something to look at later. But for now, we're just going to treat man compliance as what the authors say, which is a potential function for this challenging behavior with a precursor or a precurrent of repetitive speech. And that's really the main point of this article. Look at the functional analysis, see if we can confirm man compliance past just the descriptive method, and then look at a subsequent intervention. The hypothesis was that problem behavior functioned to increase the probability of reinforcement, meaning that we had to develop an intervention that reduced the occurrences of challenging behavior, and then subsequently fade that schedule of reinforcement so that it's not an overwhelming intervention for caregivers to eventually manage. There were two participants in this study. They had a decent amount of comorbid diagnoses as well as a decent amount of challenging and interfering behavior. This was done on an inpatient hospital unit. Now, the authors do note this, that sessions were done in very controlled settings with experts at running this intervention, and they did talk about generalization after the fact, but as you go through and as I'm talking through some of these interventions, I want you to note that there was a lot of safety measures in place. Now, I did work on the neurobehavior unit for a little bit, and so I know what the unit looks like and the amount of training the staff gets, and there's a lot of safety measures. There's even 24/7 nursing staff on site with doctors and other multidisciplinary team members. All that to say, there's a lot of support on site. So when you look at interventions like this, they're going to be hard to just directly translate into your normal clinical setting. I don't want to say take it with a grain of salt, because the behavioral principles are solid, and I think the intervention path isn't a bad intervention path at all, but just know that there's going to be modifications, right? For example, their functional analysis, which we'll talk about in a second, wasn't based off precursors. It was based on the specific interfering behavior that each of those clients had. Now, most of my, I would say, if not all of my functional analyses, whether they're synthesized or isolated, are all based on precursors, simply because I think it's a safer, and I've never had loss of treatment validity based on the precursor analysis, and research backs that up. So you probably would have to make changes like that to this intervention, and that's just your standard way of modifying interventions and treatments and things that you see in research to better apply to you. Specifically because these were some pretty challenging behaviors that they were working with, and they were in a very restrictive environment, I thought it was worthwhile to call up here and have a conversation about it. So their functional analysis was very straightforward. I assumed that they did a standard functional analysis, isolated, that came out undifferentiated. That's typically the first path that they do at Kennedy. But then they moved on to a more specific, more isolated functional analysis, where they really wanted to look at two simple test control conditions. The test was contingent on repetitive speech. The therapist would redirect to another topic. Contingent on challenging or interfering behavior, the therapist would respond to that repetitive speech with the preferred responses that the client had. So they had an example of what's the weather today, and the client's asked what's the weather, and the staff responds with a certain string of text, string of vocalizations, that is the preferred response for that client. The control was no contingencies for interfering behavior and consistent reinforcement throughout. So anytime the client vocalized one of their repetitive speech instances, the therapist responded in kind. And that was it. That was the test control. They looked at the repetitive speech and they looked at the frequency of repetitive speech across different contingencies. And then they, of course, looked at the interfering behavior. And for both clients, what they saw was pretty straightforward. They saw repetitive behavior, repetitive speech stay high in both conditions, which is what you'd expect, and interfering behavior to be much higher in the contingency in which they weren't reinforcing repetitive speech. They were only reinforcing interfering behavior. That was the test condition. And that confirmed that not responding to the repetitive speech was the function of the challenging behavior, the precursor to the challenging behavior. So then we moved on to the intervention. This is a classic Kennedy intervention. There's a green lanyard and a red lanyard that denotes two different multiple schedules of reinforcement. Or one multiple schedules of reinforcement, the two schedules being green was the client way, which was reinforcing repetitive speech all the time, and then red was therapist way, which was contingent on repetitive speech. They used extinction, response interruption and redirection, and differential reinforcement for alternative topics. So what this looked like is the client would engage in a repetitive speech episode, and then the therapist sitting next to them would not respond to the repetitive speech, instead use RARD to talk about something else, and then differentially reinforce that other alternative topic. So, hey, what's the weather? we already talked about the weather. Instead, let's talk about the XYZ that you always like to hang out with. What do you think they're doing today? Simple as that. However, you can't just go in with that being all therapist way and no client way. Of course, there was a fading of schedule, and that is where the red and the green came in to denote which schedule the client was currently experiencing. They started with, of course, heavily reinforcing the client's way at the green card, and then eventually faded and shaped the schedule up to 50-50 or more of the red card, depending on the specific topography and the client. This is a pretty standard schedule fading off multiple schedule intervention. You set up two different schedules, and then you fade the availability back and forth, and you progress at the speed individualized to the client. So typically the way they run it is within a 10-minute trial, you start with 5 minutes of green, 10 seconds of red, and then 5 minutes of green again. And then you progress to 5 minutes of green, 30 seconds of red, 4 minutes and 30 seconds of green. And you slowly fade that red more and more often. So what were the results? I already talked about the functional analysis, but they saw that repetitive speech was a precurrent behavior, that it was a precursor as well. So differentiated functional analysis, very clean, and schedule thinning went pretty well with a couple of hiccups. Now, they didn't give us a lot of information on where those hiccups exactly were in the schedule thinning process, but it seemed to be towards the beginning of the intervention and around the middle. So I'm assuming that's where we went for the beginning, that first time they were experiencing the extinction, RARD and DRA contingency, and then in the middle, probably where we were hitting that 5-6 minute mark of being unavailable. That's probably where the hiccups were. So overall, pretty straightforward article, and it was a pretty solid analysis and treatment. The authors point out a couple limitations, specifically that there was really no clear data to support RARD as a treatment component. Typically, when you look at RARD, it's what color is your shirt, touch your nose, what color is my hair, as a response to reduce, or as an intervention to reduce the future probability of that behavior. It is a punishment procedure through and through. There's no arguments to be had about it. It doesn't look like punishment, but it is, by definition, a punishment procedure. And there was really no data, there was no component analysis to determine if RARD was really needed as a treatment component, which is definitely a weakness of this article. They should have done a component analysis. I will say, though, and this is where I give them a little leeway, it seemed like within their description that RARD was used less as a contingent on this, get flooded with 3 to 5 questions that are non-preferred, to be more of, oh, we're not talking about that. Instead, let's talk about that. And that was their RARD. Because they had the extinction component, which is, oh, we actually are not going to talk about that. But then their RARD was just discussing a different topic. It didn't seem, let's talk about this, let's talk about this, let's talk about this. It's a different topic. So for me, yes, it is still a punishing procedure. I think it has a little bit more social validity because it looks and feels more like a typical conversation that you would have with a peer if the peer didn't want to talk about what they had already talked about. If they already talked about Pokemon 5 minutes ago, they don't want to have the same conversation about Pokemon. Potentially, they might. And you only know if you try. The authors also make a point to say this is not some new functional analysis. It's just a manipulation of the current if-then relationship, right? It's just a modification to the functional analysis. Personally, I read this. I'm pretty sure they just wanted to be like, this isn't some new fancy ISCA or something. Who would do that? But regardless, I think a functional analysis is just an evaluation of a functional relationship. It's evaluating two different variables and seeing if there's an if-then relationship. To me, that was kind of a wasted line because obviously this isn't a new functional analysis because all functional analysis methods are under the umbrella of the functional analysis logic, not some magic four-condition functional analysis that we should use every day. And that more or less wraps up the article, but there's just something else I want to talk about here. And I think this denotes a values change that I've had as a practitioner within the last 1.5-ish years of being a practitioner, 2 years. And that's that when I read this article, the social validity case didn't seem super clear to me. And there's a couple lines, and you could go through this article with a fine-tooth comb, and you could draw all these conclusions only to find out that all of your conclusions are wrong because the journal editor cut 20 paragraphs that made the social validity case. So we're not having this conversation to say, oh, these authors suck, and it was a bad, unethical article. That's not what I mean at all. But the information that they gave us, I think it prompts an interesting question about social validity, especially because this intervention at its core was changing preferences, right? It was changing the contingencies around verbal and vocal behavior. And whenever we get into the reduction of language, I always get really worried, or the redirection of language, I guess you could say. I always get worried. So this isn't to say that these authors did something horribly unethical, but it's just that with the information that they gave us, specifically in a couple points, I don't know if I would have taken that path. There's a couple lines that were important here that made me come to this conclusion. The main one saying that they noticed a pattern, and this is how they knew to run this functional analysis and then intervention, that there would be a decent amount of challenging behavior at the beginning of the staffing or at the beginning of the client's time on the unit. And then as staff learned the preferred responses to these repetitive speech, then interfering behavior would decrease. And I was thinking about that, and I was thinking, if all we needed was the preferred responses, isn't that the intervention in and of itself? Don't we have the reduction of behavior right there? Why did we need to go through a functional analysis and an intrusive treatment and all of this in order to get the result that we already had with a little bit of information being provided? For example, anytime that person is staffed, you could hand them a book and say, this is what they want you to respond with. Easy there, right? The problem solved without any of this interfering hoobaloo in the meantime. And I realize that maybe there's one of two scenarios going on. And like I said, we don't know which one is actually happening. And the reality is that the authors probably told us, and it was just cut due to length of the journal. But regardless, scenario one. Let's say the client continually escalated due to switching of the preferred phrasing from the speech, from the staff. They asked one question but wanted a different response, and it was just impossible to keep up with. Every few days they would switch up the preferred response, and any time the preferred response wasn't given immediately, it resulted in immediate escalation. Regardless of if the staff knew the client really well or not, the client themselves were making changes to the preferred responses, and we would get escalations continually every 3-ish days or earlier, just randomly without any predictability to when the responses were going to change, right? That's scenario one. I mean, I think we can all agree that what I described at the beginning, which was why don't we just learn the client better, wouldn't work in that situation, right? That is a situation where intervention and boundary conversations do have to occur. Scenario two, the client has specific patterns that they like to hear, and these stayed consistent. The client was able to not escalate the problem behavior as soon as they hear that phrasing. For example, hey, what's the weather? The client wants you to always respond with, it's sunny with a chance of rain. And that stays consistent. There's no changing. And that's the end of the story. There probably doesn't need to be a behavior reduction intervention there, right? Because it stays consistent. What's the big deal about engaging in a client's preferences, right, about responding in speech in a certain way? Maybe instead of doing a behavior reduction intervention in that case, maybe we do a skill acquisition intervention. Maybe we don't look at multiple schedules of extinction and redirection. Maybe we look at increasing social skills and building up play skills and building up collaborative and parallel and all of those different leisure skills that can shape into independent communication outside of repetitive speech patterns. Look at expanding instead of reduction. And of course, we don't really know which scenario occurred. I'm assuming, honestly, that it was probably scenario number one, which then leads to, yes, we do need an intervention. And this is one of the ways that you could approach that intervention. It's definitely not the only way. But I think it's worthwhile to think about, right? Whenever you read these articles, just because they're published doesn't mean that they're the end-all be-all of ethical decision-making. It just means that they were published. We always need to triple down, look at assent, look at buy-in, look at social validity, communicate with the caregivers, talk to the clients, learn about the person, and really develop a holistic intervention package that is focused on the person and not just on, oh, I see problem, I reduce problem. Anyways, that's all I got for you. I hope you enjoyed this one. It's a little bit back to basics with just a pure intervention discussion. I hope you enjoyed it. I definitely did. I'll see you in the next one. So there you have it. That's the end of our podcast. It would mean the world to me if you commented or shared or whoever you're interacting with this content. Subscribe if you're on a podcast platform. It means the world to me. And also, if you're available, give a review to this podcast. Give it 5 stars if you love it. Give me feedback if not. I read every single one, and it does a ton to boost the visibility of content like this in the overall algorithm. If you want to continue engaging with the Behaviorist Book Club, the best place to go is the ABA Cafe Facebook group. You can find it just by typing in the ABA Cafe into your Facebook search bar. It is a group of research-minded practitioners engaging and collaborating together to become better behavior analysts through our application of practitioner-focused research. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.